This morning, to wrap up both the semester and also the story of Abraham and Sarah, since we finished the text of it next time, and we're going to start on Isaac, I guess in 3 weeks, right? The next 2 weeks we don't have class. But in order to do this, instead of the usual going through the text, I thought, as I promised you last time, that I would bring this book called The Five Books of Miriam by Ellen Frankel, and also make you aware of another book that I have not yet seen, but I know was just published in the Reform Movement, which is a commentary on the Torah exclusively by female rabbis. And I don't remember what it's called, and I have not yet seen it, but it exists. Something that, of course, was inconceivable in an earlier age. Although there was a book called Senna or Anna, although I don't think that it was written by a woman, which was specifically designed for women to learn Torah. So we're going to talk for a little while today. I don't know if we'll fill the whole session because we're not looking through any texts, but we're going to talk at least for a little while today about the unvoiced perspective of the Torah, and that is the perspective of women who have some voice in the Torah, but it's clearly muted, right? It's a lot less. It is much more the story of the men in the Torah than it is the story of women. However, that's in one respect that's true, and in another respect it's not true. By that I mean the Torah tells more of the man's story than the woman's. For example, Moses was married, but we know very little of his wife and a lot about Moses. And yet, it was as much her story as his. It's just that we don't have her story. So to say that it was his story and not hers is only to say that his story was told and not hers. And the same is true of all the patriarchs, even though we have much more about the matriarchs than we do, say, about Zipporah, who was Moses' wife. So the strategy that this book uses, which is an interesting one, and I certainly recommend you're looking through it if you don't know of it, is she creates a Torah commentary through the voices of women in the Torah. And she identifies each of them and what their perspective is. So for example, she has our daughters, our mothers, and our grandmothers all speaking collectively. She also has the rabbis. Then she has Lilith, the rebel. Right, Lilith is the Midrashic character who first married Adam and rebelled against him. Sarah, the ancient one. Hagar, the stranger. Wily Rebecca. Wily means clever. Clever Rebecca, granddaughter of Milcah. Mother Rachel. Leah, the namer. Dinah, the wounded one. Serach bat Asher, the historian. And so on, Miriam the prophet, Huldah the preacher, Esther the hidden one, Bruria the scholar. Bruria is a Talmudic character, was married to Rabbi Meir, and is the only woman who's in the Talmud who has rulings or legal opinions quoted in her name. That's why she calls her Bruria the scholar. And she has all these people in succession commenting on the stories of the Torah, and I thought that I would give you a couple examples of the stories that we've been looking at to see what they say. One example, the first one that I marked off was, you recall that when the three angels come to Abraham's tent to announce that Isaac is going to be born, what does he do? He says, Sarah, go prepare some food, right? She does. He presents it to them. And who in the Jewish tradition gets the reputation for being hospitable? Abraham, right. So she says in here, our bubbies, that is our grandmother's ad, and she has a great proverb. This is a Yiddish proverb, and it's perfect for the story. The food is cooked in a pot, and the plate gets the honor. Right? So the same thing here. Right? Sarah's out in the back being the pot, and Abraham is the presenter. That's all. But everybody says, what beautiful plates you have. Nobody ever says, gee, I wonder what kind of pot, right, this food was cooked in. But there's, of course, a deeper truth in this, which is that the ability of any patriarch to be patriarchal depends on all the other needs in his life being matriarchally handled, right? Otherwise, Abraham would have had to say, wait here, let me go cook something. And the angels would have, you know, cooled their heels at the tent outside waiting for Abraham. But his ability to be called hospitable is dependent on her. But there's a good example of a story that's unvoiced, but you can reconstruct it in your mind if you pay attention to what he hasn't said. And that's, of course, part of the attempt of books like this, is to reclaim the unspoken stories. Here's another one. You remember what happens, let's recall the story of Lot, and then we're going to move to the stories that we've been dealing with in the past few weeks. Remember the story of Lot. When the strangers come to Lot's house, not the strangers, but all the townspeople come to Lot's house, what does he say to them? Do you remember?
Take my daughters.
Take my daughters, right? God forbid I should violate hospitality. I have a couple of daughters. After Sodom and Amorah is destroyed, what do his daughters do? They sleep with him. So she has Dinah the wounded, one says. How can we not recoil? That means spring back or be upset at Lot's willingness to sacrifice his daughter's virginity to protect two strangers under his roof. At least when Abraham decides to sacrifice his son, he's answering to God. Lot, on the other hand, is yielding to wicked neighbors and social convention. We shouldn't be surprised that his daughters later sleep with him. He's already essentially violated their chastity and made his priorities clear to them. Right? So she connects the two stories, and the connections become natural once the perspective is shifted, right? Once it's the story of the women involved, so you look to see what happened earlier to the women involved and what happened later. What happened earlier was their father was willing to sacrifice them. What happened later is they sleep with him to get children, right? Because he's already let them know how he thinks of them. So part of what makes this an interesting and worthwhile endeavor is it helps you connect up stories that are told that you would otherwise not pay attention to, right? You might not make the connection between Lot's daughter's earlier experience and their later, but once you say, I'm going to focus on the fate of women in the story, so everything ties together. So this is interesting. Here is a good example of the way in which the rabbis answer a question and the way in which she has Hagar answer the question. Abraham throws Ishmael out of the house, right? Ishmael is a kid at the time, at least the way the story reads, he's a kid. What happens to him the first time he's thrown out of the house? Do you remember? He's going to die, right? He's dying of thirst. And what does Hagar do? She turns away, right? She can't stand to watch him. And then a well appears, right? And Ishmael is crying, and she turns away from his cry. So the rabbis say, Hagar's eyes are so blinded by tears, she can't see the well nearby. Too overcome with grief at her son's approaching death, she fails to attend to her own survival. But when Ishmael cries out, the angel appears and reassures Hagar that they will both live. It's the child's selfishness, not the mother's selflessness, that storms heaven's gate. Okay? That's what they're saying. And that's why they say Ba'asher Husham. When the rabbis later on say, why did God save Ishmael? After all, later Ishmael was going to cause all sorts of problems. They answer, because God judges you where you are now, not where you may be 20 years from now. Okay. That's the comment of the rabbis. Hagar's comment in Ellen Frankel's rendition is, sometimes it's our children, speaking from where they are, who teach us how to see what we need to survive. They see it as Hagar, as a mother, learning from her child. Again, not impossible that the rabbis would come up with this perspective, but less likely than that a mother would come up with this perspective. So reading the Torah through the eyes of the mother yields a different lesson than reading the Torah through the eyes of the rabbis. Also, some things that I would guess are mentioned in rabbinic sources, although I don't know for sure, are quoted here and take on a different significance when quoted here. Remember what it says about Sarah's death. What does it say? She was 100 years and 20 years and 7 years. To which the rabbis say, you know, that she was old, but she had the beauty of youth. She was, when she was young, she had the wisdom of age, and so on. She says, Bruria, the scholar, notes, it's the only time that a woman's age is given at her death. She doesn't say what it means, but she attends to the idea of age and women differently than the rabbis do. I'm open to theories, by the way. If you have any theories about why it is that that's the only time that age is given at a woman's death, I don't know. What's that?
They were allowed.
I can't hear you.
They were not allowed.
They were not allowed, right? Because they didn't tell them. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's what the rabbis say explicitly. That's how the rabbis put it, right? That she was as old as this, as but still, why specifically Sarah? Yeah. That's true, but she's not more significant than Rebecca or Rachel or Leah.
She may not be. Yeah. The earlier you get, the more you see of these primitive things. And she's given an honor by giving her age.
It could be, although I would make a case for Eve. Eve's not primitive, right? Because Eve is the one who actually has the curiosity to eat the fruit. Adam is primitive, because Eve says to Adam, eat this, and he just goes, okay. Right. Yeah, he's watching football when she comes in with the apple. He has no idea. But she's certainly far less developed a character than Sarah. And ultimately, I don't know if there is more of an explanation, but it's worth thinking about. It's worth thinking about. Okay. Few women in the Bible receive a special blessing. None but Rebecca receives a blessing from her mother, right? When it says Achloteinu Atihi Al Alfei Revava, I guess that the mother blesses it too. I always think of it as her brother, because it begins Achloteinu, our sister. But that is also mentioned here. And then I love this, and this is, you remember, I never located the essay. I told you that Maurice Samuel has an essay called Rebecca the Manager. I used to have the book, and I can't find it. I'll look for it again, see if I can uncover it. I probably loaned it at one point, and we'll never see it again. Some writer, I think it was Andre Gide, said the only books that he has in his library are ones he's borrowed from someone else. You know, so all the ones he's loaned out are long gone. So anyway, but this is if Maurice Samuel doesn't note this in his essay, then Alan Frankel has a good one on him. Just as I asserted, this is Rebecca talking about love at first sight, right? Why does she fall off her camel? The rabbis say that she was so overwhelmed, right? And the word is vatipol, which literally means to fall. And Rebecca fires back, why don't you try spending a few days riding a camel? And then she says, just as I asserted my own will in agreeing to this marriage, because remember, we saw that it was Rebecca who agreed to the marriage, so here I asserted myself in meeting Isaac eye to eye. That's why Eliezer identifies Isaac as his master, not mine. That's what Eliezer says. That is my master, Isaac. Doesn't say that's your master. And in fact, in subsequent stories, we discover that Isaac is not Rebecca's master, not by any means. If anything, it's the reverse. Because in me, Isaac had more than met his match. Okay. Now, that again, it gives a voice to Rebecca that you can imagine actually is authentically Rebecca's kind of voice that you don't hear in the Bible. And then, you know, I talked about veiling. I never heard this interpretation, but I like this one a lot. I talked about how a veil, you know, hides who you are, and there should be someone before whom you don't wear a veil. And then it says, this is again from our bubbies, our grandmothers say this. And may the bride live to know the joy of motherhood and learn that a mother is like a veil. She hides the faults of her children. which is a really nice, you know, a mother is like a veil. She hides the faults of her children. If you've ever taught or been a counselor at camp, you know that that's true, right? The mother comes in and says, my child could not have done that, right? You may think that my child hit you, but it must have been. It's like Sam Levinson used to have this great line Harold Kushner likes to quote. Sam Levinson was a Jewish humorist. He wrote some very funny books, but now they're mostly forgotten. But he said when he first went to school, to kindergarten, he went with a little sign that his mother wrote and hung over his neck, which said, if Sammy misbehaves, hit the boy next to him because he learns by example. So, so our mothers hide our faults. Okay, and I have just two more examples because I only went as far as we had gone in the biblical text, but then I can look a little earlier and see what else she has for, in particular for Eve, I find interesting. I wanted to say this one thing. Because part of the pleasure of this book is to trace the personalities backwards. That is, Rebecca comments on the Adam and Eve story, for example, but in the voice of Rebecca. So what she says is, it's Adam and Eve's bite, not the serpent's, that proves poisonous to the serpent, not the other way around. By the time the story ends, the serpent's fallen flat on his face and eaten dust, right? Because that's what happens. Adam and Eve bite the apple, and they upset the serpent, as opposed to the serpent biting them and upsetting them. Okay. So remember what it says about Rebecca when she marries Isaac. What happens? It's actually a very lovely single line about domestic life. It says that she came into his tent and he was healed from the pain of his mother's death, right? And so Rachel adds, the greatest miracle of all was that Rebecca's love healed Isaac's heart, which had been broken by his mother's death. Because the rabbis talk about the miracle of light returning to the tent, right? That light comes back to the tent, but that's not what Rebecca thinks is the greatest miracle, right? Rachel says the greatest miracle. Rachel thinks that the greatest miracle is that Rebecca's love healed him. The last one is about Keturah. And I'll read through this because last time we talked about whether Keturah was Hagar. Remember, we had that conversation. Abraham has all these, for those of you who weren't here last time or don't remember, after Sarah dies, Abraham has a wife, Keturah. And with him, he has all these children. None of his children inherit. And some of them actually even grow up to be oppositions to Israel, like Midian. So the question is Keturah Hagar? That is the Keturah Sarah's maid that he had a child with Ishmael years before? Is Keturah someone new? And on. So these are the comments that she has about Abraham's wife Keturah. Our daughters ask, who's Keturah? Why is it that Abraham's concubine Hagar gets recognition as the ancestor of the Arab peoples, but Keturah, Abraham's second wife, because remember, in one reading it says Isha, wife, remains invisible in the tradition. What do we know about this woman whom Abraham marries after Sarah's death, or of the six sons they have together, whom Abraham ultimately sends off eastward? What are her origins? What do we know of her life, her character, and her death? Okay, there is already, it's a different question from the question we asked. We asked, who is she? Right? We wanted to identify her, but we wanted to identify her because we wanted to know what Abraham did. Not because we were interested in her. Nobody in the last class said, gee, I wonder what Keturah was like. You know, I wonder what dreams Keturah had. I wonder what she did with her days. We were only interested in her because we wanted to know about Abraham. She was a walk-on, so to speak, in the picture. But if you're looking at the Torah from the point of view of women, then you want to know about Keturah, not only about Abraham. So Keturah answers, just in case you were wondering. I was only a child when I married old Abraham. All I brought with me from my family and birthplace was my name. I've been told it's a name full of stories. Some have said it means tied up or captive. So perhaps I was acquired by Abraham through battle or purchase. It's also related to incense. I sometimes imagine my family were important in, as priests or spice traders. There are even those who've said that my name comes from Keter, meaning circlet or wreath, and therefore I'm of royal descendant, a princess like Abraham's first wife, Sarah. Now, all we get is Keturah, all we get is her name, so she's made of it as much as she can in order to try to recover who this person was. The sages in our own time comment, since the Torah regards Abraham as the father of all Middle Eastern peoples, perhaps Keturah serves to represent the peoples of the East, since spices come from that region. Her children include Midian, who will be influential in the biblical story later on. And then finally, Hagar. What does Hagar have to say about it? No, to the Torah, she's only a third wife, maybe merely a concubine, a footnote to the main events. It's up to us to imagine her story. So it's a very interesting project to try to imagine. It reminds me, there was an essayist named Max Beerbohm, who was an English essayist, who wrote beautiful, wonderful essays, and he has an essay called A Clergyman. And this takes a lot of background to explain it, but I'm going to do all this. The most famous biography in English literature is called The Life of Johnson by Boswell, right? Samuel Johnson was a remarkable and amazing man. He also wrote the first major dictionary of the English language all by himself, right? And Boswell's Life of Johnson really records, he basically followed Johnson around for several years and recorded his talk, right, what he said. He was one of the most remarkable speakers just in normal conversation in the history of literature. And he follows him into bars and out of bars, and he listens to him say things to people and all the wise things he says and all. And also, he listens to him as Johnson did. When someone says something that he thinks is foolish, he listens to him put him down, right? So in one case, there's a clergyman who makes a very tentative comment and Johnson just blasts him, right? And Beerbohm writes a whole essay about this clergyman because he's never mentioned again. We don't know his name. We don't know who he was. And he starts to imagine, here's this timid clergyman. He sees the great Samuel Johnson. He thinks, this is my big shot. Right, I'm going to say something to impress Samuel Johnson. If you impress Sam, everybody knew who he was, right? And what happens, of course, is he gets shot down. He tries to imagine how he felt. And that kind of reconstruction of somebody who otherwise doesn't get preserved is the sort of project that's going on here with all of these women in the Torah whose stories are just glancingly mentioned. And it seems to me it's not only a fascinating but a very worthwhile project, even if you're not convinced by the interpretations, because it allows you to reimagine the stories and to and it enriches even your appreciation for the characters that you do know about, right? I mean, the more you can think about Tzipora, the more it lets you know what Moses' domestic life must have been. Yeah.
Is there something in there about Sarah's reaction to the Akedah?
I'm sure there is. I didn't actually look at the Akedah particularly, but I mean that's obviously a story that is in which the rabbis also talk about her reaction. I'll tell you what it says here. There's this brief passage. Our daughters ask, where is Sarah when Abraham and Isaac set off for Mount Moriah? What are her reactions when her husband goes off with her only son? Why is she silent? The rabbis answer, this is the rabbinic answer, after Abraham and Sarah and Isaac leave, Sarah goes to Hebron looking for them. Satan, the tempter, the adversary, the alter ego, appears to her and reveals that Abraham intends to sacrifice her son. Hearing this, her heart breaks from sorrow and she dies. As it is written, Sarah died in Kiryat Arba, now Hebron. But others teach that Satan reveals to her that Abraham spared her son from his knife. Then her heart bursts from joy. Such is the anatomy of a mother's heart. Sarah, the ancient one, retorts, what do the rabbis know of a mother's heart? That's all she says, right? So there you have it both ways. Although my guess is that Sarah's being unfair, and I'll tell you why I assume so. The rabbis don't know of a mother's heart only on the assumption that they never went home and discussed these stories with their wives. But my assumption is that actually even in the Talmud you hear the voices of the wives of the rabbis, though you don't know it. But if you think that none of them ever said to their husbands, you know, you might consider that this or this, that, I mean, maybe even the story of Sarah's dying after the Akedah came from a rabbi's wife and not a rabbi, but it's quoted in the name of a rabbi. So I don't know. I think that it's writing off too quickly the influence that someone has when they live with someone else to think that all the interpretations we're hearing are only from the rabbis and not from their wives. So, yeah.
Is there support for this type of interpretation? Because now, in thinking about Lot and his daughters, it becomes an act of aggression or vengeance instead of
right, it does.
A very nice thought that yep. they're carrying on.
Yes, it's true. When you say, is there support, among whom? Well, there's the field of feminist scholarship is a huge field in Jewish studies. So there's support. I mean, there are lots of people who are involved in feminist scholarship in Jewish studies.
Has anybody else interpreted this?
I don't know. Probably. I wouldn't be surprised. There are a number of feminist biblical scholars who teach at various universities, some of them are actually quite well known in the field of biblical studies. But whether that specific story, it seems to me any reading that's plausible is going to get a good hearing these days. And especially, you know, the fashion is the other way these days. The fashion is specifically to concentrate on voices that haven't been heard. I heard this already. I think I mentioned this story, but I'll tell you again. I heard this already in rabbinical school. It was, I think, the first time I was confronted with it in my own reading or writing or research. Benjamin Gampel, wonderful guy, great teacher, he taught us medieval Jewish history. And so we studied the Spanish Inquisition, and I became interested in writing about Abravanel. And Abravanel was the leader of Spanish Jewry, and when the Spanish Jews were exiled, Ferdinand and Isabella, he was treasurer of the kingdom. And Ferdinand and Isabella actually made a plot to kidnap his grandson so that Abravanel wouldn't leave because they wanted to keep him. The plot was foiled. He left with the Jews rather than converting, and he could have had a very good life. He left with the Jewish people, which always made him heroic to me. By the way, the best biography of Abravanel was written by a scholar named Ben-Zion Netanyahu, which is Netanyahu's father. Right, Yehonatan and Benjamin Netanyahu's father wrote the classic biography of Abravanel. Anyway, so everybody had to pick a topic for their paper, and I came to Gampel and I said, I wanted to do Abravanel. And he said, why Abravanel? And I said, because I just think it's so tragic. Here this guy goes off on a ship and he leaves behind Spain and he could have been successful. And he said, you know, I understand what you're saying. He said, but I think of all the other people. He said, I think of all the mothers and the kids who didn't live at the court of Ferdinand and Isabella and weren't going to get off the ship and be honored like Abravanel was and couldn't write great commentaries on the Torah. He says, they interest me much more than Abravanel. So that was my friend that I remember the first time that a historian explicitly said to me, I'm less interested in the quote unquote interesting people than I am in the people whose stories weren't. I, by the way, still wrote my paper on Abravanel, but that's in part because it's a lot easier to get information. I mean, I was in school, I wasn't looking for the hard one. It's a lot easier to get information on the famous people than it is on the not famous people. But these days you can read lots of books about populations, about peasants, about women, about religious groups that were disenfranchised, but this is new. It really is new. Up to now, the last 100 years, history was, you know, kings and queens. That was history. But not anymore, and occasionally armies. So.
But the dynamics that the mom is probably behind the scenes, and maybe she affects the family, but it doesn't show. The interesting thing that when Sarah dies, Isaac mourns for her. But when Abraham dies, it really doesn't mention that, well, he died and they're burying him.
Right.
So maybe the main dynamic was her, but
it could be right that their children. Well, that's also part of, the principal early teacher of every kid was the mother. So the connection presumably was that much greater. And you have to look for clues about that, but it does make sense. I mean, the people mourn for Miriam. She's a different figure from Moses. They mourn for Moses too, but it's a different, you know. I don't know. It's a very interesting thing to try to reconstruct. And that would be a good project. I wonder if someone would ever do that. It's too speculative to prove it. But it would be a good project to go through Jewish teachings and try to identify which could surreptitiously have come from women as opposed to men, which are more characteristic. But the problem is that since you have no evidence, it would be very hard to do. Yeah. Right.
It's a very different thing than women speaking in their own voice. And so it's missing.
No doubt about it. But
the major point, which is that the reconstruction of the story and what was the influence of the power were the men who were bringing this in, and that became the accepted.
Well, I agree, but I don't think it's missing the major point. I think it's conceding the major point and saying, given that that's true, is there any way to try to reconstruct the voices that weren't heard? I mean, I think it just assumes that point. Otherwise, you're not looking. The only reason you're looking for the buried voices is because they're buried, right? The same thing with the peasants. Why are people trying to unearth what the peasants said and talk? Because their voices are buried and they're lost.
Right. Know the mother's heart, and he said maybe he did because he talked to their wife. But there's a thing there about she would have been joyful if she was alive, right. But she would have been sad and died if he got died. But the complexity of what happens to mothers who see the father sacrificing the son and the willingness to do that and the betrayal there's a whole other complexity to the heart.
There's no question about that, but I wasn't saying that the rabbis were mothers, but to say that they have no knowledge of a woman's heart is like saying of women that they have no knowledge of a man's heart, and that's clearly not true, right? If you live with someone, you may not be able to express their heart for them, but you have some knowledge of it. We're not completely different creatures, but you're right. If Sarah spoke, I have no doubt that her voice would be completely different from anyone who speaks in her name. There's no, you know, it's an unrecoverable loss. All those people. I mean, just look at English literature. Once women, for example, started to write novels, so all of a sudden you have a Jane Austen or Jane Eyre, the Bronte family, all these voices. And if you have those voices already in the 18th century, imagine what you would have had in the 15th, 14th, 13th, 12th, keep going back. It's not as though all of a sudden women had a voice. It's just that before that, their voices, if heard at all, were heard only by their children and then lost. So behind you, yeah. It's true to some extent. The focus is still not their story. How about, I would say, they're strong supporting characters. It's not their story. And as the Torah goes on, especially with Moses, the voices of women get weaker and weaker. So, yeah, it's true. I mean, look, one of the reasons why everybody loves the book of Genesis is because it does have the richest of all the family stories. You know, if this class were Leviticus, all I can say is I'm going to make Genesis last as long as possible. I don't know where we're going to go after Exodus, okay, but once you get to Leviticus, it's very hard. Yes, down.
Right. And equally so in the woman. And
I don't, I mean, she certainly doesn't paint them as perfect. Let's put it that way. So, let's see. Here's a good one. Right, I saw this yesterday and I meant to mention this. So do you remember the story about how God says to Adam, don't eat from the fruit of the tree, and then the snake comes to Eve and says, you're not allowed to eat from the fruit of the tree or touch it lest you die, right? And that's not true that you're not allowed to touch it. So the rabbis imagine that what the serpent said was, you're not allowed to eat, what did God tell you? So Eve says, you're not allowed to eat from the fruit of the tree or touch it lest you die. The serpent goes over to the tree and touches it and says, see, you're not gonna die. So you can eat, right? And so the interpretation of this is that Eve has misunderstood the commandment, and by misunderstanding it, she makes it too stringent and that destroys it. What Rebecca says in here is, if only God had spoken to Eve directly. Because what God does is speak to Adam, right? Then presumably Adam tells Eve, and as it says in here, it's like a game of telephone. You know, by the time it gets to the end, it gets distorted. If God would just, you know, talk to Eve, she would have gotten it right. She would have taken a message. And but she spoke to Adam. And as we know, Adam was watching football. I'll tell her when she comes home. Dear, don't.
He spoke to the weaker sex.
Yeah. Well, biologically, you're right, after all. I mean, not in terms of physical strength, but in terms of resilience and length of life and ability to absorb pain and all of that. That's true. So, yeah. Okay, I tell you, that's that. I told this story once, I don't remember, in a sermon, but this is how I think of it. I said one time to Ellie, when we were in the kitchen, which to me is a foreign country, so I said, I put the pot away, something like I put the pot away, but I put it in the wrong place. And then I said, that's redundant. Oh no, she said, you put the pot away, you put it in the wrong place. I said, that's redundant. Like obviously if I put the pot away, I said, you could have just said you put the pot away. She said, no, I could have just said you. So. But see, she's not in front of you to tell the story. So you got to hear it from me. Yes.
Is it possible that when Adam told Eve about the commandment God gave, that he said, don't touch
it? It is possible that he got it wrong. It's very possible. Why blame Eve? It was, could he, as I said, maybe Adam didn't know how to take a message. Okay, so let me... This is nice. Okay. Our daughters ask, the Torah states that Eve's Hebrew name, Chava, comes from Chai, meaning life, because she's the mother of all the living. If Eve is the mother of all life, does that make Adam the father? Leah, the namer, answers, because Leah names all these children, right? So she calls her Leah the namer. Adam's name derives from Adama, earth, the source of material being. Chai refers to the source of spiritual being. Or, to avoid an unnatural dichotomy, Adam and Eve have given birth to each other. From Adam's sleep emerges Eve, from Eve's awakening, Adam's future. Very nice, isn't it? So, the five books of Miriam from Ellen Frankel, and I don't want to call it a game to play, but it's an interesting game to play, which is, what voices would you give to the people who don't have voices? Not only female, male, female, children, characters who don't speak in all sorts of ways, what would they say? Which, by the way, I just want to say, that's the game the rabbis play with Midrash. That's exactly what they do. What did Abraham and Isaac say to each other on those 3 days on the way to the Akedah? So they fill it in. And that's no more legitimate or no less legitimate than trying to figure out what Sarah said when she heard about the Akedah, or what Eve said when they were punished from Eden, or, you know, what Moses' wife said when he came down from the mountain and smashed the tablets. You know, was she happy with him? Was she upset with him? Did she say, you shouldn't have smashed those tablets? Did she say, I'm proud of you? She must have had some kind of reaction, right? The rabbis wonder, why is it that Moses' two sons don't go anywhere in the Bible? This is part of the structure of Harold Kushner's book called Overcoming Life's Disappointments. He talks about Moses' sons. So how did Tzipora feel? Maybe Tzipora said to them, listen, you can do whatever you want, just don't go into Jewish leadership. It's possible. It's entirely possible, right? When I got my GREs, do they still take GREs?
Yeah.
I had to take GREs to go into rabbinical school. When my mother got my score, she said, you could go to law school, right? Because she was married to a rabbi. So she said, why are you going to rabbinical school with this? Go to law school. Maybe Moses' wife said, what do you want this for, right? Do something constructive with your life. Don't go into Jewish leadership. Look what happened to your father, right? He's got nothing but tzuras, and then he doesn't get to go to Israel. Do something else. Who knows? Anyway, any questions, comments? Yes, please.
I would like to know about Esther
Hiddens. Yeah, Esther, that's right. I only had the beginning. Let me see if I can find a comment from Esther at the beginning of the story. Oh, here's one. Here's a good one. Why doesn't Abraham give more to Hagar and Ishmael, right? He puts a pack on their back and sends them off, okay? He could have given them a camel, a servant, or at least a blessing, right? That's what our daughters ask. So Esther, the hidden one, answers, in acting this way, Abraham demonstrates his faith that God will provide. In other words, she believes in the hiddenness of God's providing. He takes to heart God's promise that Ishmael will become a great nation. The episode is a rehearsal of his later test of faith with his other son. But Dinah, the wounded one, who doesn't see God so trustingly, says, it could have been otherwise. Sarah, after all, only orders to send the two of them away. It's Abraham's choice to give them so little for the journey. So she tries to keep them consistent through the book. But as I say, I've only read the beginning of it because it was sitting on my shelf, and it wasn't until all of you said, what about the women's stories, that I thought I really should take this book off and look at it. And when I did, it's great. And I will, as we go along to the different parshiot, I'll keep this, you know, open and let you know what it says for each of them. So, and by the way, the author, Ellen Frankel, who is the editor-in-chief, by the way, of the Jewish Publication Society, which is how I know her, but I don't know her through her books till now, got her PhD in comparative literature from Princeton and lives in Philadelphia, which is where Jewish Publication Society is located. And I think the book is still in print. It is published by Putnam, and it's called The Five Books of Miriam. So if you're interested, there it is. Yes. One, two. Well, hold on one sec. Yeah. Go ahead. According to, it doesn't say exactly, so it could be that she died right away, because her death is mentioned right after. She could have lived a while, so it's not clear. Yeah.
You said the Torah mentions Hagar's age?
No, only Sarah's.
Oh, Sarah's.
Only Sarah's, right. We don't know how old Hagar was, which is an interesting question.
I just realized she died when she was
27.
And wasn't she giving birth to Isaac when she was 99?
Yeah. Right, according to, yes. Well, no, actually we have. The rabbis think that Isaac was in his mid-30s in the Akedah. That's at least one, according to one calculation. But they don't, but it's clear when you read the story that he's younger than that. So, but anyway, yeah. It's in the Bible. It is in the Bible. Yes, one, two. Oh, the Jewish Publication Society publishes a whole range of Jewish books, scholarly books, popular books, novels, kids' books. It's, I think, the oldest continuous Jewish publication organization in America, and I urge you to support it, not only because it's a good publication society and it's in Philadelphia, which is my hometown, but because they publish a lot of good books, including collections of articles of scholars. And for example, They have one of the papers whom they've collected is that of Tikva Frymer Kinsky, who unfortunately passed away last year. They have about five or six master scholars whose papers they've published. They published their major articles. Tikva Frymer Kinsky was a feminist biblical scholar who taught at the University of Chicago, and they published her collected papers. Yeah.
Why does the Torah—
I can't hear you.
Why does the Torah only mention
Sarah's
age?
Oh, no, it mentions Abraham's age as well. But I don't know why it only mentions Sarah's age at her death. That is the question that's asked in here, and so far we don't have a good answer to it. But if you come up with one, let me know, because if you do, I'll let Ellen Frankel know that we have an answer. Okay, and if we go on with this, I'll email her and ask her if she ever comes out to Los Angeles. Maybe she'd come and speak to the Torah class. All right, thanks very much.